Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm talking with Peter Ludlow. Peter Ludlow received his PhD in philosophy from Columbia University in 1985. He's written, edited, or co-edited 10 books, including High Noon at the Electronic Frontier and Crypto-Anarchy, Cyberstates, and Pirate Utopias. And he's published over 50 articles in scholarly journals on issues ranging from the philosophy of time to issues in artificial intelligence. He holds a permanent appointment at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. How did you go from being a philosophy prof to being a cyber rights theoretician?
My sort of direct route into hooking up with people working on cyber rights and so forth came about when I was a junior faculty member at here at Stony Brook. And one of the deans decided that my work was, I think he characterized it as being behavioristic, monistic, mechanistic, and in profound conflict with all religious teaching about the nature of human beings, or something like that. I forget the exact quote. I should have it memorized. And then he began this attempt to get me basically removed from Stony Brook. And along the way, he was, led to kind of crazier and crazier actions. And among the things he did was to accuse me of hacking into the university computer system and reading his email. And I guess the evidence for this was the fact that I'd worked in artificial intelligence at Honeywell's artificial intelligence group, and therefore I was some sort of threat and had some sort of capability to hack in and steal his email. So from there, it sort of became clear to me that a lot of talk about hackers and so forth was just paranoia towards individuals that have, you know, certain technical backgrounds or certain technical interests. And from there, I got involved with various people with organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and so forth.
Now, EFF, for those who aren't familiar, they've been working for a long time on protecting cyber freedoms, net privacy issues, and restricting the ability of the government to censor pornography and other types of issues.
Yeah, that's right.
You, in the most recent volume, Crypto Anarchy, Cyberstates, and Pirate Utopias, you have John Perry Barlow's manifesto for cyber autonomy.
His Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace.
Right.
Yeah.
To reflect on that for a second, I mean, that is a very interesting document, but in the wake of 9/11, it seems bizarre, in a sense, that there would have been people who would have argued for and be quite fond of the notion of a completely autonomous and anarchistic domain out there in cyberspace.
Yeah, right. It seems a little bit anti-patriotic since 9/11, but
well, it's not just that. I mean, the notion that this disembodied world out there on the net could be considered an independent regime separate from our embodied polities, not just the unpatriotic the United States or any particular nation state, but that these two things aren't really that separate. It seems like a kind of Cartesian dualism, perhaps, that ignores the actual embodiment that everyone who's on the net could actually get blown up in the real world.
Right. Well, that's the main criticism of the John Perry Barlow stuff. You know, I live in New York City. I don't live on the net. I think once he held up his laptop and says, "This is where I live now," something like that. The essay is interesting. It's arguably kind of over the edge. But the point of the collection is to include things that are over the edge, just to get discussion rolling. And the discussion I wanted to get rolling with that piece was the idea that there, if not a total sovereignty of cyberspace, whatever that might mean, that there would be notions of some forms of sovereignty or legal sovereignty emerging online in various locations. and that certain connections we make online and so forth, certain kinds of business relationships we enter into, certain kinds of personal relationships that we enter into, if they're going to be legally, if there's going to be something that has legal sovereignty over them, it's probably not going to be a standard terrestrial government. It's going to be some sort of online governance system.
You talk about some of the efforts of multiple user groups and online gaming communities to develop some of those governance structures, going back and forth between anarchy, democracy, monarchy.
It's true that there are kinds of governance structures that are emerging. Maybe the majority of those fizzle out, who knows. And there are kinds of real live legal entities being created on the web, or in the web, I should say. You're right. They're going to be completely diverse. That's one reason that it's sort of bizarre for John Perry Barlow to talk about the sovereignty of cyberspace, because there is no one cyberspace that's going to be some sort of legal entity, right? Or have one sort of notion of sovereignty, but there are going to be lots of little, as it were, cyber principalities emerging.
I can't tell you how many lists I've been on that have had to painfully learn the lesson of governance, mostly because of the disruptive behavior of, you know, particular individuals. Maybe one in 500 can ruin the whole
thing.
That's
right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's sort of the source of all of these governance structures. You can think you're running an experiment in anarchy or something like that, but that only lasts so long. And, you know, a little bit of noise can make the list or the user group unusable, right?
So there's a couple things going on. One is that the cultural uniformity of the folks who tended to use the Internet as of 15 years ago has disappeared. Now there's this great diversity. There was also the economic boom in the high tech and kind of general economic boom of the 1990s, which, as that collapsed, it seems to have also brought down with it a lot of the optimism about the Californian ideology, as it's called, the kind of techno-anarchism. Do you see that economic connection as well?
Well, I saw the whole dot-com boom as kind of a threat to the more interesting elements of the Internet, and a little bit of a threat to the sort of diversity that hopefully we'll continue to enjoy. I'm not at all surprised that it happened, and I assume that for the people that I anthologize in this book, they're not the least bit troubled by the, you know, the collapse of the bursting of the dot-com bubble.
I'm speaking with Peter Ludlow. He's a philosophy professor at SUNY Stony Brook, the editor most recently of Crypto Anarchy, Cyberstates, and Pirate Utopias. You include in the volume people responding to John Perry Barlow, people from the anarchist or libertarian voices who agree with him, most part, as well as people like Dorothy Denning and David Brin. Can you talk about that reaction against the cyber anarchy, the call for crypto anarchy and cyber anarchy?
Yeah, well, I think Brin's concern was just, as I recall, I think you've had him on your show recently.
I did,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. Did he talk about this here?
Yeah. We talked about the need to reaffirm our membership in civilization.
Yeah, that's basically the beef that he had in this essay that I anthologized, which is it amounted to a kind of escapism, and that's something you want to avoid. Dorothy Denning's concern is a little bit different. She tends to come at things from the perspective of the law enforcement community, and she's basically, when people like Timothy May talk about crypto-anarchy, that's the sort of concept that she recoils from, right? As I think she says she doesn't want to live in anarchy, and she's interested in ensuring that these tools of crypto anarchy, as it were, are not do not become too widespread, and that they're not abused by certain criminal elements.
Yeah. There's some evidence that, for instance, that the terrorist networks have used cryptography. But even Dorothy Denning acknowledges that it's impossible now to have any public policy that does anything about cryptography because it's already out there and there's nothing to do about it.
Yeah. I don't doubt that they did. Probably they did. Probably they also used automobiles at some point and rental cars and box cutters and all sorts of other things. Not a surprise if they did. I don't know if they did or not.
So the technologies aren't the problem. It's the criminal intent.
I would never say that technology is neutral. But I don't think that, you know, there are obviously certain individuals that are using these events to argue against civil liberties in cyberspace, for example. People are just coming out of the woodwork arguing that, you know, this event shows us X, where X is whatever their pet peeve is, right? So Falwell and so forth says what this shows is, you know, there's like too many homosexuals and et cetera, and that's why this happened, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, there are individuals, and there have been for a long time, trying to get more restrictions on our cyber rights. And so it's no surprise that, you know, people are taking advantage of this to try and to do that now. I doubt that it's would help in terms of fighting terrorism.
Mm-hmm. So an increased ability to wiretap email, for instance, is one of the proposals on the table. Do you think that that is distinctly different from the kind of wiretapping that we've had before? Is that when you talk about cyber rights and cyber liberties, would delimiting and restricting government's ability to look into our email be one of those rights?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. And so are you uncomfortable with the proposals out there now?
Well, I'm a little bit unclear of what the proposals are right now because, I mean, the initial ones were horrendous, but, I mean, it sounds like the House Judiciary Committee or whatever has been taking out some of the most problematic elements of it, and right now it's kind of a moving target, so I don't really know exactly what's going to come out of committee and what exactly is going to pass. But I mean, it's not clear to me that that any of these things being done right now are going to be helpful vis-a-vis terrorism, and they do raise problems. I mean, obviously, if you look at the coalition, it's both on the right and the left is concerned about this, and with good reason.
Mm-hmm. When we look around the world, the notion of the libertarian web is pretty much attenuated in a lot of parts of the world. China has very strong limits on what people can see through the web. They don't allow people to see foreign news sites, the Washington Post, New York Times. Singapore has a national web filter on. Do you think that the trend internationally is towards increasing filtering and delimitation of people's cyber rights?
Well, I think there's probably an intention to do that. I don't think it's going to work fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually people are going to be using satellite phones and so forth, and I just, it's going to be harder and harder for governments to enforce this, and, even given current technology, I think it's difficult for governments to enforce that sort of thing, and I doubt that China, for example, is going to be able to make this stick.
I really want to thank you for talking to us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I've been speaking with Peter Ludlow. He's a philosophy professor at SUNY Stony Brook, and he is also the editor most recently of Crypto Anarchy, Cyber States, and Pirate Utopias. Speaking with Dorothy Denning. Dorothy Denning is a professor of computer science at Georgetown University. She's one of the country's leading academic experts on computer security, cyber terrorism, and information warfare, and is a key government advisor on computer security policy. Her 1982 book, Cryptography and Data Security, was the standard text in the field for many years. She's author, most recently, of Information Warfare and Security, an Internet Besieged, Countering Cyberspace Scofflaws. Welcome, Dr. Denning.
Thank you.
Now, your writings in the late 1980s argued that the security community should be more tolerant of hackers. You argued for a constructive engagement policy with the hacker subculture. And then in the early 1990s, as you got more involved with and got to know more people in the intelligence community, you became increasingly concerned about what was happening out there. Is that a fair characterization of where you came from?
Well, in the early 1990s, I was looking at other issues. So at that time, I was starting to look at issues related to law enforcement more and, you know, how we can fight cybercrime and looking at what the impact of certain technologies like encryption were going to be on the ability of law enforcement to function effectively.
The reason we're speaking this week is, of course, the advent of our war on terrorism. You have noted in a number of your papers, most recently a paper you wrote a year ago on cyberterrorism, that terrorist networks were using various kinds of email encryption and I presume also telephone encryption on occasion. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about? One classic example apparently is Ramzi Youssef's encrypted files on his computer. He was one of the masterminds behind the first World Trade Center bombing.
That's right. Yeah, when they seized his laptop computer, they discovered that there were encrypted files on there. Fortunately, they were able to decrypt them. There, you know, have been indications from the government that they have encountered encryption in some of these terrorist cases, but I don't know the extent to which it's encountered. I don't know how, you know, predominant it is. We have been hearing, in this recent case, that some of the people who were engaged in that attack were using electronic mail, but that was not encrypted. So there could be a substantial amount of communications that, in fact, wasn't encrypted.
You note in one of your writings a report that bin Laden equipped his headquarters in 1996 with a computer and communications headquarters, and that he had Egyptian computer experts build him a communication network. Do we have any other information about the extent of those capabilities or whether they are ramping up towards cyber sophistication?
Yeah, that was the extent of the knowledge that I had. And I had gotten that from another source, and I don't know, you know, what people inside the government may know in addition to that.
One of the issues that you've been involved in the past has been the issue of key escrow systems. Can you tell us what key escrow is and whether it would have any relevance to national security issues?
Well, key escrow refers to encryption systems where there's a backup key of some type that allows access to those communications. It allows somebody to decrypt those communications other than the, you know, original sender and receiver. And those backup keys could be, you know, held by a trusted third party. In the case of the Clipper chip, they were actually held by two government agencies.
Right now we're exporting encryption technology without key escrow, but there had been a debate in the middle 90s that we should only export technology with key escrow. Would that have made a difference in the use of foreign governments or paramilitary organizations in their use of, for instance, pretty good privacy encryption?
Well, it's hard to tell. In the case of pretty good privacy, that had been developed and put out on the internet even before the idea of key escrow was really seriously discussed in the public. And so at that point, you know, if, for example, bin Laden had been using pretty good privacy, it would have been too late because he would have had a version without key escrow. I think what came out of all those debates was a realization on the part of really everybody that there were a lot of very serious obstacles to doing key escrow in any effective way, not the least of which is, you know, what reason would you ever have to believe that the bad guys would use it, you know, especially if the U.S. government had access to the keys. Instead, they could just use encryption that was developed overseas that, you know, didn't have the USA stamp of approval on it. So that was just one of many hurdles. Other hurdles were, you know, it was recognized that building these systems in any way that would be comprehensive was going to be not only costly but also very risky, because when you're effectively putting a back door into something, there's the potential that hackers could exploit it. So that, you know, that was another obstacle to it. And then finally, a third obstacle was that by limiting what U.S. companies could build and export, we were hurting their ability to be competitive in the global market.
So cryptography is pretty much already out of the barn. There's not much that you think we can do about the use of cryptographic methods by bad guys out there.
I think it's out there, and that at this point it would not be wise to attempt to rein it in, or really possible.
In the film Sneakers, which I'm sure you've seen, the plot MacGuffin is a piece of computer hardware that is programmed to crack every conceivable computer security code, and the heroes realize quickly that that device could bring down key parts of the U.S. infrastructure, airport security, with a water system, electrical grid, and so forth. Is our infrastructure really vulnerable to computer hacking in that way? If determined groups of hackers were able, through whatever methods, to get a hold of access, electronic access to our various infrastructural computer systems, could they wreak havoc that way?
Well, first of all, there is no black box like in Sneakers that will decrypt anything. That was a good piece of fiction, but it really was fiction. And second of all, the way the hackers are breaking into systems really has nothing to do with encryption, and it doesn't involve breaking encryption systems, and generally encryption would not prevent these kinds of attacks. What they're doing is exploiting some very simple vulnerabilities that are present in the servers that are out there on the Internet. And because so many servers have the same vulnerabilities, they can attack quite a lot of systems.
The Clinton administration has looked at infrastructure vulnerabilities in the past and determined that there were some, though, however.
Well, there certainly are. It's important that we protect the cyberstructures as well as protect our physical land.
Now, you say that there isn't, that the idea of a black box which could crack anything is still fiction. There's been some suggestion that if we were to have dramatic advances in computer technology, in particular quantum computing, that those kinds of computer technologies might make our current encryption methods obsolete.
That's not true. There's really two kinds of encryption systems. There's the very conventional cryptosystems that were originally developed. These are things like the data encryption standard to be replaced by the advanced encryption standard. These are called symmetric systems because the sender and the receiver use the same key. These systems are generally not that vulnerable to breakthrough in quantum with quantum computing. Right now, those systems, if you have a 128-bit key, they're very secure. If tomorrow there was a quantum computer that could break that, all you need to do effectively is double the key length, and you'd be protected. So that's not a major problem. But there's another kind of encryption that's also widespread. That's public key encryption. And most products use both of these. The public key encryption is used to handle the keying, the key management aspect of it, whereas the conventional encryption actually encrypts the content. My understanding is that the public key would be much more seriously harmed by a breakthrough in quantum computing.
The Osama bin Laden network has also been rumored to be using a technique called steganography. Can you tell us what steganography is and whether there's actually any evidence of steganographic communications?
Yeah, steganography involves hiding the existence of the message or communications. So whereas with encryption, you scramble it up, somebody can look and see, well, that looks like noise, and they can tell it's encryption. But with steganography, you might embed it in an image that's posted on the web, and just looking at that image, you can't tell there's a hidden message in it. You need special tools in order to put the message in and then also to take the message out. I have heard that some of the people in bin Laden's network were using steganography.
And in porn, in particular, I read.
This was an article that was in the USA Today last February. They said that he was putting it in porn images and also in images on sports websites.
You've written that drawing on the work of others, that there are various levels and stages that a criminal organization or terrorist organization would go through in becoming more sophisticated in their use of computer-based offensive capabilities and defensive capabilities. In particular, that developing your own viruses and developing your own offensive cyber warfare would take several years, unless you hired people in from outside. Is there any evidence that denial of service attacks or viruses that have been proliferating in recent years may be having a terrorist origin, that those terrorist networks may have invested those resources and have a cyber warfare function?
Well, I don't think that's the case. I think that these are just being developed within the so-called hacker community, which is a huge community. It's a worldwide community. Now, some of the people that are affiliated with that community or associated with it in some sense may also have ties into terrorist organizations. I do recall reading in a report that was written by iDefense last January, they analyzed the cyber war that erupted over tensions in the Mideast between Israel and Palestine. And they looked at all the various hacking groups that were participating in the cyber attack, and it involved a lot of denial of service attacks and web defacement. And I was just scanning that the other day and noticed that a couple of the groups evidently had some ties with a couple of terrorist organizations. So that doesn't mean, the terrorists so much are turning to these methods, but that, people who may be, affiliated with these organizations in some way themselves may be getting into these methods.
Speaking with Professor Dorothy Denning, she teaches at computer science at Georgetown University, is one of the country's leading experts on computer security policy, and is the author most recently of Information Warfare and Security. There was another connection to the Al-Qaeda network, which was this case. Can you talk a bit about the case of Khalid Ibrahim, who was involved in the Indian separatist group?
Yeah, that was an interesting case because there was a group of hackers, I think they were called Masters of Downloading, who had gotten into Department of Defense computers and had downloaded a lot of files and some software and so on. This in and of itself is not particularly unusual since there have been many incidents like that. But what was unusual in this case was that one of the hackers who went by the name of Chameleon was approached by this person who wanted to buy the software from him, and in fact, I guess had even sent him a check for $1,000. And it was when Chameleon cashed that check, I guess, that the FBI caught the FBI's attention. I guess they paid him a visit. So, this terrorist organization, I think, might have had some ties also with Bin Laden.
We have a new Office of Homeland Security now that's going to be created. Do you have any recommendations that you can make public of how our efforts against cybercrime, cyberterrorism can be coordinated among the different agencies?
That's going to be a challenge because, in coordinating all that, I'm not sure what the authorities of that office will be over all the various government organizations that are involved with this. I mean, we have the Commander-in-Chief of SpaceCom had authority over computer network defense and computer network offense for the Department of Defense. So, I don't know where his authority and responsibilities now come in with this new office and cabinet position. So I have a lot of questions about it, and right now I'm afraid no answers.
Well, I really appreciate your talking to us today. It's been very fascinating, and I expect that the issues will continue to get more interesting in the future. I've been speaking with Dorothy Denning. She's professor of computer science at Georgetown University. She's author, most recently, of Information Warfare and Security, An Internet Besieged, Countering Cyberspace Scofflaws.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for joining us today.
Okay, bye.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.